They've still not dealt with the football operation. They've still not dealt with the players and the recruitment department. They've still not dealt with the stadium, which is rusting and needs massive money spending. Manchester United need £1 billion in this next 2-3 years to either rebuild or renovate that stadium. They probably need another £500-600 million for training ground and other infrastructure projects and football investment. They've only got £40-50 million cash left in the bank. They were cash rich 3 years ago. They had £350 million in the bank. They've no longer got that money in the bank. Something is going to have to give soon. Very, very soon.
Hello and welcome to the Sound of Football podcast. I'm Graham Sibley, and as ever, I'm joined by Jan Bilton.
Hello.
And Terry DeFellin.
Hello.
We're all calm. We're all ready for a nice week of football chat. Yeah, we're not going to be losing on the touchline, I hope. Not for the next three quarters of an hour anyway, at least. but who knows? Who knows? Things might be said. Handshakes might be made, and well, you never know. It could all break out. We could start pulling each other's hair out, couldn't we?
If that's what it is.
Yes, I suppose we're alluding to the Chelsea-Spurs game yesterday. That was a bit entertaining, wasn't it? Is it just because it's the start of the season, lads, or is this going to be the way that the season's going to pan out this year?
I think people just like watching violence. People just like violence. And now, it was an entertaining game. Don't get me wrong, but it obviously was made much more entertaining by the fact that the two managers went at each other. But it was, yeah, I mean, it was a bit naff, really, with Tuchel dancing down the touchline when they scored. And I suppose it was the best and the worst advert for English football in equal measure.
Terry, do you think that Tuchel did actually purposefully do a Mourinho? That he actually saw a video of Mourinho back in the day and think, yes, I'm going to do that. I'm going to do that running down the touchline, giving it the double fist pumps.
Yes. Yes.
Beautiful insight there, Terry.
Because, I mean, the man is a student of the game. He studies the game and he studies other managers. But, I mean, he's relatively young manager. I mean, he would have been, you know, an up-and-coming manager when Mourinho was in his pomp at Chelsea. He would have watched those games. He watched a ton of Premier League. He loved the Premier League. And maybe he wouldn't necessarily gone, first chance I get, I'm going to do the Mourinho run down the touchline thing. But he would have known what those Chelsea fans love. And they would have loved that and probably did love it and would have endeared into it. And that's what that whole thing, I think, was about. The more I think about it, which I think about it far more than I should have done. But certainly on Tuchel's point of view, this was performative. This was a sort of, I am the Chelsea manager and this is how Chelsea managers behave. And it's straight from the Mourinho playbook of mind games. It's kind of cute, really. It's kind of adorable. There's a darker issue here. I mean, we spent quite a lot of time, you know, praising the women's Euros and, you know, enjoying the different kind of atmosphere that was at women's football matches. But I don't want to come across as rugby union by saying, oh, well, you know, down with this sort of thing. You know, I mean, all right, Jan, you know, I don't want to come across as like pro cycling in that case and saying down with this sort of thing, right? There's a place for it. I think it's interesting that that's what Sky Sports led with post-match. This is what the Premier League is all about. And I'm thinking, well, is this really what you're leading with? Is this what your brand is? It's sort of like, you know, middle-aged men aggressively shaking hands with each other. I mean, I'm not certain that that is really what the Premier League really should be all about since they were celebrating 30 years. So it tells you a lot about the show business that is the Premier League, that is the narrative that is the Premier League, and actually overshadowed what was a really stonking game of football, proper
certainly
good game of English football. I loved watching that game. As I've said before, I haven't watched that much Premier League, you know, as much as many other people do, because I tend to watch a lot more foreign stuff. But that was a proper game, the best game of football of the weekend.
Well, without doubt, it was. And had it been on Saturday, it may have been the first game on Match of the Day. Though, of course, that slot had already been pretty much assured, hadn't it, really? Yeah, it's interesting what you say there, Terry, about Chelsea needing someone who can play the mind games, who knows which buttons to press with the fans. What would Man United give for someone who understood them and could press their right buttons right now and have something, have a psychological edge over their opponents. Erik ten Games, I think that's quite generous at the moment, but how bad is it going to get? I mean, I reckon it could turn around. I reckon he'll he's not going to win this weekend, is he? On Monday, he's playing Liverpool. That won't go well. That won't go well at all. So, well, if he loses his first three games, that's fine. Arsenal did this last season. They lost their first three games, and they only missed out on Champions League just really at the last gasp. That was partly down to Tottenham really turning it around at the end of the season and going on a tear. I don't want to devote the next sort of half an hour to, aren't Man United rubbish? Everything that is wrong with this club is down at the Glazers. Because we've had this conversation quite a lot over the last couple of years. So I want to try and have a conversation about what the root of this problem is, how they're going to dig their way out of it, if they can, or is this just a natural event from the whole of what's happened to them over the lifespan of the Premier League, over the last 30 years? Were the seeds sown for this even before the Premier League started? That's maybe what we can look at and say, well, yeah, you've had all your success. The problems you're having now could have something to do with all that success you had beforehand. Maybe that's it. And maybe we'll learn something new perhaps today in our conversation. But let's go for immediate reactions on the weekend's result. Brentford 4, Manchester United 0. Terry, what was your immediate reaction when you saw it? Did you watch the game for a start?
I didn't watch the game. I had to catch the highlights on Match Today the day before. It was Mrs. De Felen's birthday, and so I was not disposed to be watching football. But I was catching. I was staying across the results.
She shares her birthday with Alan Shearer. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Well, there you
Isn't
go.
That wonderful? Okay, well. Yeah, of course, because they said on Match Today, didn't they? Yeah.
Yes.
Anyway, I was across the result because, you know, I can't escape the football, even if I am out entertaining. Yeah, it was one of those results when you're stunned initially, and then the more you think about it, you go, well, this has been coming, hasn't it, really? And it felt like chickens coming home to roost. I'm trying to think of similar examples that might be, but I guess I could only maybe think back to maybe the days of the Liverpool decline in the early 90s when they would often get beat like that. One time they got beat 2-0 by Norwich, for example, and it was panic in the streets and, you know, cats and dogs living together and that kind of thing. It was insane. But Brentford are an extremely well put together, highly well coached, well disciplined bunch of players, and Manchester United are at the moment a complete rabble. I did say in the preview to bring popcorn, but I wasn't expecting it to be this bad. You know, I foreshadowed the possibility that this could be a shock result, and so it proved to be.
Yeah, was it a shock result?
I think the manner in which they collapsed in the first half, that was shocking. I mean, had they lost, you know, let's say De Gea didn't cock up two goals. if they'd gone there and lost 2-0, we would still be quite excited and animated about all of this, but I don't think it would be quite as exciting and interesting and funny as it is seeing them implode in that manner. As you said, you can talk about what's going on behind the scenes at the top of the club in terms of the finances and things like that, but the reality is that that set of players were not set up right to deal with what was happening. De Gea, clearly his mind was elsewhere. Maguire looked shell-shocked from after the first two goals had gone in. I'd only be too unfair on Martinez, mainly because I wasn't too familiar with him until the weekend, but clearly Brentford put a lot of pressure on quite a pint-sized player, put some muscle on him with Ivan Toney, and he just had him for breakfast the whole game. So looking at how they are and amongst themselves, the motivation inside of that team, and they started badly last week as well, it's not a surprise is the long answer that they got beat. It's the manner of in which they went under, which was just spectacular.
It is going to take something special for them to turn it around, especially in their next game, which is against Liverpool. Now, as we speak, we're just a couple of hours away from seeing Liverpool play Palace. And the only time we've seen Liverpool play this season so far is against Fulham, and they got a draw there. If they draw again tonight against Palace, we may be saying to them that, ooh, what's going on here? This is not the best start of the season for them. But let's assume that they're in a much better place at the moment than United are, because all evidence would suggest that. Now, United have the opportunity to turn it round. As I said earlier, Arsenal lost their first three games, including losing away to Brentford at the beginning of last season. So there is the opportunity to turn this round. All they need is a good result to get under their belt. But I can't see it happening. I just can't see this side just suddenly turning up and having a good game. It just seems that there is something so fundamentally wrong there. Erik ten Hag looks like such a poor fit there. But he doesn't look any worse, I suppose, than the last four managers they've had there. Maybe Michael Carrick is the exception there. But I think all you have to look at is Christian Eriksen. He played the second half of the season for Brentford and was amazing, was incredible for Brentford last season. He's played two games for Man United in a false nine and defensive midfield. And he looked utterly lost. And I think that just sums up what you were saying, Jan, about the players not knowing what to do, not knowing how to get out of this situation.
If you want to be kind to Ten Hag, you could possibly say that the players are just refusing, but saying what Ten Hag is asserting, and that the players are refusing to stick to the game plan, and that's why they appear to be the rabble that they are. But then you put that up against the positioning of Eriksen, for example, who is neither a number nine nor is he a defensive midfielder. He's not even really a deep-lying midfielder. You might want to play him, I suppose, as a deep-lying midfielder, but that's not the position we're used to seeing him play, and that surely isn't his principal strength. That's when you think, well, look, hang on, has he really got a grasp of his team? Has he really got a grasp of his players? And does he fully understand their strengths and weaknesses? And that's when you do have to ask questions about whether the coach is good enough. But it could also be a case that, you know, he's got so many square pegs and so many round holes that he's trying his best to fit together a formation that makes some kind of sense. You know, bearing in mind that he's got Ronaldo that he's got to play, and Ronaldo's problems with his lack of pressing, and this is something that he is, in some respects, a bit of a throwback footballer. He doesn't really press. I don't really think he ever has done. In his genuine pomp, pressing wasn't quite the thing. And he's played so long for Real Madrid where they went many years without really having to do any pressing because that was Real Madrid. And so he's got all of these problems with his squad that don't quite fit, can't quite get the players that he wants. And he's looking like he doesn't know what he's doing, which is hard to believe because he's had a good career as a coach. He knows how to set up a team. But going back to what I was saying in the preview, Ajax is an extremely well-run club from top to bottom. And they understand the kind of football that they want to play. And they try and roll that out at every level. And the players that they bring in, they know will fit within that structure and work to that playing style. And so the coach's job really then is to ensure that all of the systems are in place and that, you know, the finer points and the details are finessed. And Ten Hag has proved to be extremely apt and able to do that at Ajax. But he has to go to a football club in Manchester United that doesn't have any of that. And he's struggling. But he's not alone, Graham, as you point out. I mean, he's, you know, the last coach who probably knew what he was doing there, dare I say, was Mourinho.
Yeah.
And no one liked him.
No. And he knew he wasn't liked there. And so far quicker than usual, he decided to manoeuvre himself out of the club, which we've seen time after time at other clubs. And it was almost as if, well, he won't do it here. Yes, he will.
Mm.
The whole Eriksen situation just really underlined it for me. Well, you saw the way how abject he looked, especially for that second goal when he got given this hospital pass from De Gea. This is David De Gea, and I know that lots of people have been putting out their own thoughts and their own hot takes on Twitter to say, oh, well, he's only a shot stopper. His numbers are pretty useless in every other measure. Yeah, he's one of the best goalkeepers in the world. And yet he has no belief in himself anymore. It doesn't look like that anyway. The body language of all of those players out there was dead as soon as the first goal went in.
Yeah, completely. There was the shot of Maguire with his 1,000-yard stare floating around on Twitter, which was awful and entertaining at the same time. But yeah, with Eriksen, I thought that was a brilliant signing for them.
Yeah.
He's one of the best players in the world, so why wouldn't it be? And to add to their already well-established and incredible attacking lineup, to put him in there behind them, I just thought that, you know, it's going to be great. But then playing him out of position for two games and putting him in defensive midfield, you're right, he got embarrassed. And De Gea helped that along. I'm looking at the stats now, and it's got Eriksen down as the error that led to the goal. It wasn't his error, really, was it? He was fed that. But I mean, to not get the best out of a player like that is really concerning. You know, I said last week, it's only one game. I'll say this week, it's only two games. next week I'll be saying it's only three games, Graham, nothing to worry about. I mean, I think he'll turn it around. He's got some games coming up which I think are winnable, but he's clearly got to get the players right. And that's going to take a hell of a lot to turn them around from that absolute battering.
Yeah.
There's some big egos in there, and that's going to take a lot for them to turn around. The Ronaldo thing, he didn't start him in the first game. He started him in this game. Was that a knee jerk? The stuff around Eriksen we talked about. Fred, he's had his critics across the whole of last season as well. Although he occasionally does turn in a good performance, but you've got to wonder why he's there. Shaw as well doesn't look like the greatest player, and why is he in there? But just to look at what are the options in terms of who they could bring in, some of the names they've been linked with, just having a look through the gossip pages from the last week, Morata, who's 29, Jamie Vardy, who's 36, Arnautovic, who's 33. And you look at what the guys, the noisy neighbours, have been doing in terms of their business. You know, they're not entertaining anybody of that age that's just that's been there and done it. Well, maybe hasn't actually done it. They're going for world-class young talent. And that's really what Manchester United's legacy is, isn't it? It's about exciting young players that are coming through and doing it. And they've done that since well before I was born. And obviously, you know, Fergie brought in some incredible, incredible players during his time and blooded youngsters. And this is just a mess.
Yeah.
I'm not going to get into the finance of it still, but you just got to look at some of those players that are on there. They're incredibly, incredibly good players. I mean, he had Rashford, Fernandes, and Sancho and Ronaldo as his attacking quartet, and they didn't land a punch on Brentford.
Yeah.
Something's really, really wrong there. I think he'll struggle against Liverpool, clearly, but they've got the options to turn it around against Southampton, who've been pretty poor, Leicester, who are very poor. So they may buy themselves some time so they can kind of just bottom out with a couple of results there, hopefully, and then hopefully just crack on.
Terry, I've got to mention a couple of players' names to you now, because they're two players when they were at clubs that you support. They were deemed as probably the best in the side at the time, or emerging talent that was going to go on to do great things. But Man United have spent big on Aaron Wan-Bissaka and Jadon Sancho, two players that you know a lot about. And what have they done to them?
Yeah, I mean, Wan-Bissaka's had a good run in the side, didn't he? But I don't think that United really played massively to his strengths. Wan-Bissaka's great strength, obviously, is pace, but also his prodigious tackling ability, you know, fantastic tackler. But I think that Man United maybe try and configure their fullbacks to play in a slightly different role in to defend Wan-Bissaka. I would say that he perhaps needed some help just settling into that new role and the expectations that come with doing that. And it hasn't worked out. It looks like his confidence has bottomed out. And I hope that he gets an opportunity to go somewhere else so that we can see what he does. Sancho's problems, I think, stem from he had an injury the previous March in 2021, and that was an injury that kind of cost him his place in Gareth Southgate's starting lineup. And so he had a really stunted, difficult Euros. And although he finished the season at Dortmund really strongly, that team was pure vibe. And it's probably been a while since he's had to come into, you know, to a new situation, and probably needed some structure. And I think he also needed some guidance, and he needed to be fit at the start of last season, and he wasn't. And the only time we ever saw anything really good out of him was when he was playing immediately after Ole Gunnar Solskjaer left. He had a couple of good games there. But I don't think that's entirely down to Manchester United what's happened there. I think a little bit of that is that the player just maybe may have been just a little bit out of sorts. And these are not far from ideal situations to come into a club like Man United, that is itself out of sorts. I mean, Sancho, and I'm not just saying that because I think he should have stayed at Dortmund. Obviously, I think he should have stayed at Dortmund. If he was going to go back to England, he should not have gone to Manchester United. And I just didn't understand why he would go to Manchester United, because the club was a mess and, you know, they wouldn't know what to do with him. If he'd gone to Chelsea, they would have known what to do with him. If he'd gone back to City, although I don't know whether they would have had him, they would have known what to have done with him. He could have gone to Bayern Munich and he'd be playing well now. So it's a bit of column A and column B, really, with Sancho. But it's obviously disappointing as a Dortmund fan. But it's, as an Englishman and an England fan, it's really disappointing, because I really feel strongly that Sancho is potentially one of our best players. And if we're not careful, he's going to be on loan at Southampton next year.
Jan was saying earlier about the reputation that United used to have for bringing youth through, especially English youth, through the ranks. But even that was a reputation that they lived on far longer than they had any right to. Everyone remembers the class of 92. That's what their academy's called. You see that it's in big letters as you walk up towards Old Trafford. But after that team, the progression through United for young talent pretty much dried up. They ended up buying everyone else in, spending a lot of money. They had to buy players like Michael Carrick, like Rio Ferdinand, like Wayne Rooney. They bought them relatively young, but they still bought them in. Whereas after that class of 92, between then and Marcus Rashford, probably the only England player of note that they actually produced was Wes Brown. And where did he end up?
Sunderland. Where he had his best years, I think it's fair to say.
I think it's fair to say that a lot of the time, the narrative around United, it's always been there in that the success they had in the 90s was just waiting to happen. This was like Ferguson's masterstroke, and he managed to control the minds of everyone around him because of the way that he manoeuvred the club. United were taking advantage of Liverpool's meltdown. They had a huge amount of money. They were probably the richest club post-Taylor Report. They sell on the stock market in 91, have an influx of cash coming into the club, attracted Beast Guy B to invest even more into the club. So they were cash rich when everyone else was trying to build new stadiums and getting themselves in hock. So they took advantage of that. They rinsed all the best youth players from around the country, bringing them into there, won the Youth Cup in 92, and then created this side that would go on to dominate the 90s, which built up the success that Ferguson had until 2013. But is that success? Is that one moment where they cashed in on everything in that early stage, became a publicly listed company, which allowed the Glazers to buy them in 2005? Was that the seed of where we are now? The fact that the Glazers are there, and they have been now for 17 years, they've owned that club. And that's why they've taken so much out of that club, because they've been there for so long. Is that the seed? Is that why all that success they had in the 90s, when Liverpool were foundering, has that led to where they are now? Terry, what do you think?
Yes, in part. I think there's two strands of thought here. The first one goes back even further, and that goes back even as far as Busby,
yeah,
and the manager complex. The idea that a single man can lead a football club, which was something that was perfectly doable and reasonable back in the 1960s, the 50s and 60s, when Busby was in control and steered the direction that that club took and took them on the road to success that they enjoyed in his time, overcoming huge obstacles and great tragedy while they were doing it. And then they tried throughout the 1970s and 80s to replicate that model and finally got it right with Ferguson. So there's that. And this has consequences now, because there's no structure within the football club to be able to accommodate the fact that your manager might not be any good. And so you've got no director of sport of sufficient authority. You've got no structure or no apparent structure to be able to absorb the problems that come with your head coach not being up to it. But then, yes, ultimately, yes, of course, this decision to float themselves in the stock market, creating huge amounts of revenue, while at the same time also, it's worth bearing in mind that we're talking about the formation of the Premier League, since Sky have been celebrating the 30th anniversary of the Premier League this week, as we know. And the huge cash payout that came with being part of the Premier League, you know, winning the first Premier League, the prize money, the sponsorship, the TV money that came from there was another level. If you remember, it was 305 million was for the first deal. It'll buy 1.5 Neymars these days, but it was a vast amount of money at the time, almost eye-wateringly so. People thought Sky were mad when they paid that money. And United cashed in on all that. But yeah, it left the door open. And these are always the things that you have to be mindful of when you're running a football club. So yeah, okay, we've got a great way of raising all this money. We've got a great manager who can make the most of this money, not just in signings, but also in bringing in, harvesting the best youth players from around the world, making them Man United players, bringing them through and creating this golden legacy. But because ultimately their structure is flawed. They weren't able to create a proper legacy. Ferguson has no legacy, apart from they named a stand after him.
Has all of the good work that Ferguson done been ripped apart, or was it already being ripped apart by the time he actually left Yan?
It's interesting hearing the way you described that, Grim, in your opening part of this section, because I couldn't help thinking, is Graham saying that Alex Ferguson was just dealt a good hand? Now, I think that would be quite simplistic to say, but I'm not taking away any of the, you know, massive success. And yes, I know that everything before but is bullshit. Right? But was he dealt a really good hand? Because you're right, all of those players were coming through anyway.
Yeah.
And at the same time, they generated all of that money. And the two of those coming together with a very gifted manager was a kind of like a perfect storm for them and allowed them to really, really dominate. And so when that ceased to be, Ferguson clearly he had to retire because he was getting so old. There was a change in the ownership, and those three factors weren't the same anymore. You said the players weren't coming through anymore through their ranks. The money was still there, although in different shapes and forms. And to try and take over from that kind of success, I mean, that would terrify anyone, even someone as dim-witted and clueless as David Moyes. I had to get that in there. So it's just the end of their time. But what is interesting, and I know we have said this before, is that his legacy is that stand being named after him, which actually probably is part of the problem with every single manager that comes and stands in front of it that are managing that team. It's brilliant to have seen all that happen. I feel fortunate to have lived through that period, but it's now a chain around their neck. That is the weight of expectation that they should be doing that, and they haven't done it for a very, very long time.
No, exactly.
You know, I know we're talking about it now because this landed on our lap and we like a little bit of easy content, but you should almost be going, well, why is this such a surprise? Why is it such a surprise they're in this situation? Because they haven't been a meaningful force in English football, definitely not in European football, apart from with the exception of that brief part when Mourinho was there. And I agree, the only decent manager they've had in a long time. But with the exception of that, they're a spent force, really, aren't they?
Hmm.
So much so that Brentford can welcome them on Saturday and know they can give them a good game and probably get something out of it. That just wouldn't have happened 30 years ago, would it?
Terry, has the turnaround been that clubs like Liverpool now are run more like Brentford than they are like Man United?
Yeah. I mean, Man United are a traditional English football club, much like Liverpool used to be.
Yeah.
But yeah, the kind of boot room tradition that did so much great things for Liverpool during the 60s and 70s, that Shankly era, it took them a decade to shake that off. More than a decade, actually, really, to shake that off. But yes, it was Midtjylland in Denmark. I hesitate to use the term, but it's a shortcut term of the money ball. The people who use the data, the analysts, it's a massive simplification of what money ball actually is. But it's that idea of going to the data, doing the analysis, finding out what you need, who you need, then doing your due diligence and getting to know the people and the personalities, and then getting a transfer committee in Liverpool's case, or a sporting director who understands how all of that works, believes in it and knows how to apply it, and then hires the right coach to go from there. And Liverpool, the biggest, best example of how that works. Obviously, this is Fenway Sports Group. We all know that John Henry offered Billy Beane a job when he was the Oakland A's coach. And obviously, he turned it down. But he took that philosophy and applied it to association football in the United Kingdom. And it worked extremely well. Now, obviously, there's more to it than the data. And if you read Moneyball, Graham lent me his copy of Moneyball fairly recently, and you read Moneyball, you'll know it's actually about human beings. It's not about the data. It's all about human beings. But you get to the right human being by looking at the data. And then at that point, at least you've got a fighting chance of getting the right player that you want. And you look at the way that Brentford have done this to huge success. On the other hand, as well, the side of it, they built a brand new modern stadium as well, which makes them a proper Premier League football club. And you've got to marry them up as well. But yeah, this is where United need to be going, but they are at least 10 years too late. And I don't know whether or not it will take them 10 years to catch up, or if it will take them even longer, because everything needs to be fixed about that club. So not just the recruitment, So you can only see it going downhill from there, apart from the possibility maybe of some kind of European Super League coming along and bailing them out.
This is probably the reason why they jumped at the chance of joining it, even though, like Arsenal and Tottenham, they probably had less right to be round the table than some of the other big clubs that were there.
They would have gone into the European Super League and just made a bundle of cash out of it, but they wouldn't have won anything,
yeah,
would they? Mm. They wouldn't have won anything at all. There's no way they can compete with the teams in Germany and the teams in Spain, definitely not the teams in Spain. You know, that would just be just an inflation of their revenues, and it would just be good for the owners, really. It wouldn't be, I don't think it would be good for the, well, we've argued against the European Super League, but it would just, you know, good for the accountants, no good for their legacy, such as it is.
In the short term.
Yeah.
In the short term. In the longer term, it would be damaging because, yeah, they're entering into a competition that they probably know deep down they're never going to win. Mm. That damages your cachet in the end. People stop supporting you. I mean, Man United have got a huge global following, a massive loyalty. And it's not just about results, because remember, they went 26 years between titles domestically, and people stuck with that football club all over the world, just as Liverpool fans did. So don't discount that. But if you become a loser football club, over time, you will stop picking up new fans. People will start to follow the other club in Manchester. And that's got all manner of unpleasant things, connotations to it, not just for Manchester United fans, but for the rest of us. Mm. I hate to say it, but, you know, a healthy English football needs a healthy Manchester United in the same way that it needs a healthy Liverpool, because these are the great traditional football clubs of our era. And dare I hate to say it too, but you have to say the same thing about the great North London clubs too. You know, Arsenal and Tottenham. These clubs need to be in place because these are the cornerstones of our professional game. When they erode, then it allows all kinds of wacky characters getting involved in other clubs who might take the game in an even worse direction than it's currently going. And yeah. So it's incumbent upon English football to try and find a solution to this.
I think that's an interesting point, that you need to have a Manchester United to have English football, if I've said that.
I believe that's what correctly. I said, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Because I think that has informed their transfer policy, because instead of buying the best player for the position and doing it that way, they've just bought the biggest name they can. Look at the last few seasons. Let's just go and buy Pogba. He's the biggest name in football at the moment. Let's just go and buy Ronaldo because he's available and we'll sell more shirts, and that's good for the cachet in the Far East. So instead of buying the players that they actually need, they're buying the players that their brand needs. And you're right, if they don't start wheeling in the trophies, you know, you're not going to be able to attract those kind of players, because it's, you know, there's a chance you bring in those big players and you're going to start actually being relevant again and actually might get some silverware. But you know, you're right. After a time when that silverware stops and you're not in the Champions League, then are those fans across the world going to change their minds? Or they kind of die out and the new ones come in and they're all City fans or Newcastle fans, which is the next thing.
What Terry was saying, though, about it taking a decade, it could take a decade for United to recover from this. Fenway took over in 2010. Between when they took over and when they got to that Champions League final in 2018. For the seven previous seasons, they'd only had one season in the Champions League. The only trophy they won in that time was the League Cup. So it was a long time to get to that position, a good couple of seasons with Klopp in place as well. You look around at clubs, where are Arsenal now? Are Arsenal in that second or third year of Fenway? Is that where they're going with like Arteta and his plan? Are Tottenham a bit further on from that? Are they? No. Terry's shaking his head. They're not. They're a bit behind. They're going in a different direction, aren't
Tottenham
they?
Have made a Faustian pact with Conte. They've adopted a ridiculously high power curve. In less than 2 years, they'll be exhausted and we'll all go back to laughing at them again. And Conte will be out. So no. There's no. I don't believe there's a plan at Tottenham. I believe there's a plan at Arsenal. But I mean, again, this is a club that's dogged with ownership problems. Arteta, I think, has been able to sufficiently influence that club to be able to get it going in the right direction. And it's paid off. Thus far, it's paid off. But Tottenham, no. Come on.
That was quite Nostradamus-esque in its clarity there. So you're like,
we don't make
this
predictions
is going to happen. This is going to happen in 2 years.
Well, I know we don't make predictions, but that wasn't a prediction. That is a reasonable forecast based on all the evidence. It's a projection, not a prediction.
I'm going to steal that and use that, Terry, quite possibly on this very podcast.
You know, I went through the whole of today thinking, we can't just spend three quarters of an hour just slagging off United. We can't do that. We've done it before and we can't do it again. But look, we've done it. We've done it again.
Well, we haven't, because we ended up, and I think agreeing that it's not in our broader interest for Manchester United to fail.
Certainly not.
Which is not slagging them off. That's not critical. I think that's helpful, constructive analysis.
Yeah.
I think.
This weekend, we get to enjoy the whole weekend without watching Man United and without the narrative. So people will have to talk about something else, you know, probably like touchline fracas and things like that. Maybe that's what they'll be talking about. Well, I don't know. Can you see Antonio Conte getting out into Bruno Lage's grill when they welcome Wolves at the weekend, Jan?
No. I mean, there might be some disagreement, but, you know, you're not going to see the silliness that you saw at the weekend.
And Terry, what do you think about Jesse Marsh when he comes up against Thomas Tuchel? Do you think there's going to be some Bundesliga vibes going on there?
I reckon there could be some Bundesliga vibes going on there, because, of course, Jesse Marsh was the subject to a handshake snub by the aforementioned Bruno Lage in the first game, wasn't he? Because he said something that was off, and we don't know what it was that he said. I hope it wasn't anything nasty. I like Jesse Marsh, but he likes the bants, and he does like the traditional American coaching trash talk stuff, which I think might rub some people up the wrong way. And so it's possible. There's no crossover Bundesliga-wise between Jesse Marsh and Thomas Tuchel. But Marsh is of the Red Bull school. And so, you know, there might be a little bit of that going on. But yeah, it's got plenty of Bundesliga vibes about that. And we shall see. I don't think that Thomas Tuchel will be on the pitch, though, will he? He'll be serving his ban.
I guess they both will. Antonio Conte, I'm sure it probably won't be there for the home game against Wolves either. But both of those games do appear in the box set this weekend, along with Newcastle Man City. Yeah, and this is obviously going to be the big game going forward for the next decade anyway, isn't it? Until Man United repair themselves, isn't it?
Yeah, I'll be avoiding that one. It'd be awful, because I'll actually be wanting Manchester City to win. and, you know, time is limited in that fixture, because with that being the outcome, Newcastle are going to win everything. By the time we're sitting around here in 10 years' time, and it'll take that long, they'll have won something before Man United turn things around. There's my prediction.
Ooh.
Interesting. Gabriel Marcotti on his podcast speculated that is not Newcastle's game plan.
Ooh.
Is not to become the next Man City. Yes, it certainly is to invest a huge amount in Newcastle, but it isn't necessarily. They're not necessarily looking to build the massive football empire that Man City are doing. But their brand of sports washing is somewhat different to Manchester City's. He didn't go into any further details into that analysis, but I'm curious to find out a man who spends an awful lot of time, more time thinking about football than I do, and he's a man whose opinion I respect greatly. So I'm interested about that, and I wonder what that means and whether or not there's anything in that. Because my assumption would be, all right, they're going to go in, they're going to try and, you know, win the Champions League in 10 years. But maybe that's not what they want. Maybe they just want to sit there in a kind of Premier League-y kind of thing and just be legitimate, rather than necessarily win stuff.
Yeah. Well, I think they said that their ambition was to win a Premier League in the next 5 to 10 years, which is a long time.
That is, yeah. And it's ambitious, to be fair.
Well, it is ambitious, yeah. But, you know, if that is the case, then the Geordie nation is going to be very, very disappointed, which I have to admit makes me very happy.
And Terry, the rounding off our weekend will be Real Sociedad versus Barcelona. Barcelona now with almost a full complement of players after pulling their last financial lever to free up some more cash so they can register Lewandowski.
Yeah, they've got one more to go. I can't remember who it is, sadly. But yes, they're good to go. Lewandowski played against Rayo Vallecano, but I mean, they could only manage a 0-0 draw. So he's yet to get off the mark. Sociedad are a good side, and I watched them play yesterday, actually, because I knew I would probably be previewing the match, and they are a decent side. So we'll see whether or not Barca have kind of settled their squad in just yet, and see what happens there. But that should be an interesting game of football. But yeah, of course, tons of narrative chucked in as well.
Tons of narrative, and tons of narrative that we'll be providing ourselves, because all of these games, of course, in our box set, which you can read in your email on Friday lunchtime if you subscribe. And if you want to subscribe, get to sofpodcast.com, click on the link for the weekend box set, and there's a little box where you put your email address in that you get added to the list, and then it comes to you. Or you can turn up on Friday afternoon and read it on the blog. It's your choice. But that is all we have time for this week. So from me, Graham Sibley, from Jan Bilton, and from Terry DeFellow, it's goodbye.
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 You can contact us through our website, sofpodcast.com, via Twitter, @soundoffootball, or on facebook.com/soundoffootball.
Are you channeling Rishi Sunak, Terry?
Am I?
The hands, yeah.
Does he do that?
He does this thing all the time now, doesn't he?